Hey friends, welcome to the Rhythms for Life podcast, where each week we talk about four rhythms that help you reduce stress and anxiety and take charge of your emotional health. Rest, restore, connect, create.
These ideas come from Rebecca's best-selling book, Rhythms of Renewal, Trading Stress and Anxiety for a Life of Peace and Purpose. So grab your copy, invite your friends, and let's live in rhythm.
Welcome back. I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Gabe. And we are so glad to be in our second episode of our marriage and parenting series and received so much good feedback last week from many of you who were glad to know that there's a place this summer that can kind of guide some of your conversations that you're wanting to have, but don't always have a good excuse. And I guess we're going to be the excuse.
Yes, we are. And this series is brought to you by Aro, and I'll share a little bit more about Aro in a few moments. But what I loved last week is we want to kick this off with Everyday Family Rhythms. And I hope that was encouraging for you. If you missed it, go back and listen, because we're going to keep going, building on that foundation that Justin talked about last week with habits of the household. So if you're interested, go back, share it with a friend. But today, let's talk about where we are this week. We dropped kids off at camp this week. Joy, in particular, is doing her second year at Pine Cove Camp. Super pumped. Like, she just posed for the camera this morning. So excited walking out the door.
It is 99 degrees.
It's true.
So it's a little hot, which is good because the camp's not, like, outside.
No.
There's moments outside.
But they do. Like, you can pack your swimsuit and your towel, and there's a whole outdoor thing with bounce houses and all the fun. So she remembers it from last year. Super excited to go. I do think camp is indicative of 99, like, degrees in the 90s. Like, that's kind of part of, like, the protocol. You come home sweaty and smelly, and then she'll sleep very good tonight.
But here's what I'm proud of. Our other two children, Pierce and Kennedy, are both working at a camp in our community that's designed for kids with special needs. So Cade is attending that camp this week.
Yeah.
And so all the kids have something going on.
Yeah.
But I love that they're serving these kids. They don't have to do that in the sense of every day. They kind of are in an environment where they're caring for a brother and a sister that have special needs, but they've chosen to go do that as their summer job. And I know that means some harder days, but also really good days. And I was telling Kennedy today just how much God's going to honor her for the way that she's contributing in this way.
Yeah, and we are family, a family who's benefited from so many people volunteering and helping our kids in camps. And, you know, that's what's happening for Joy. That happened last week in a church camp. You know, just so many wonderful people who are like, we just want to get to know your kids and we love on your kids. And I just, as a parent, as a mom, I just can't tell you enough what a gift that is to not just us, but this entire community of families with kiddos with special needs or different abilities, because it does take a village. It really does for us, for our kids to have these different inputs into their lives.
Now, I want to also mention that your new website just launched, RebeccaLyons.com. So it's always been there, but it's got a whole new makeover, and it looks awesome, including our fall retreats, which will have Lost Valley taking place October 21st to 24th for 30 couples. Go check that out. But also this podcast page, where if you want to share the Marriage and Parenting series with friends and you want to kind of give them a visual, because they don't know who I am, who Rebecca is, what is this all about? RebeccaLyons.com/podcast would be the best place to introduce people to this conversation.
Our team's been working so hard on this new website, and it's beautiful and it's comprehensive and it makes things more accessible to you. There's a freebies page where you can literally just sign up for anything that you might want to get for free, share it with a friend for free. The podcast is easier to find. Our featured episodes, the ones that deal with topics that a lot of you have emailed in about or requested. We just wanted to make things easier for you to find. So that was the goal with the new website, and I hope you guys really love it. It was fun creating it.
Now today, our conversation is with Scott Sauls, and Scott is someone who we just love and have known for over a decade. We both lived in New York together. He was a pastor of a church called Redeemer, and it was on the Upper West Side, and he was someone who was mentored as a protege under Tim Keller and then came to Nashville to lead a church called Christ Presbyterian Church. He's written multiple books. His most recent book, releasing this week, is called Beautiful People Don't Just Happen: How God Redeems Regret, Hurt, and Fear in the Making of Better Humans. And today we're going to dig into the conversations around our relationships and our families.
Yeah, we thought this was an awesome topic for the Marriage and Parenting series because we know a lot of hurt happens in relationship, especially the ones that are closest to us. We also know that healing happens in relationship. And so Scott unpacks even how we navigate that in marriage with our spouse, with someone who might be struggling with something. How do you come around that person and love them well? Whether it's your spouse, whether it's your child, how do these things that are regret or pain become beautiful people in your home, under your roof, and then therefore, obviously, outside your home?
So this conversation, we'll dig into a lot of the more personal areas that I know Scott's walked through in his own mental health challenges and depression, and he talks very honestly about that. And I hope for all of you listening, it encourages you to know that you matter in your marriage, you matter in your family, no one else can be you. And when those other people need you and we show up, it makes an incredible difference in their lives.
So since we're over here talking about rhythms all the time, we all know how much our phones get in the way of this. The healthy rhythms that we want for ourselves, our spouses, our kids, our families. And so I'm very excited about ARO, spelled A-R-O, and how easily it helps us build those healthy rhythms and habits back into our lives. I've been challenging myself for the last few months to reduce that screen time that shows up on my phone every week. And this is something that has really helped me do that. ARO pairs a Bluetooth-connected smart box, which, by the way, is beautiful. It's aesthetic. It works really well in your living room. It's just part of the furniture and a decoration. But what's so great about it is that the kids use it. We all have a fun and motivating app that automatically tracks the amount of time you spend away from your phone. So together, they help you develop the habit of putting down your phone so you can focus on the things that matter most. Maybe it's reading a book, enjoying dinner together, even watching a family movie without a second screen. Until August 31, ARO is offering the chance to win a 3-night getaway to Bolt Farm Treehouse. I don't know if you guys have seen these, but they are amazing. A luxury mountaintop retreat that, just like ARO, helps people reconnect with nature, their people, and their purpose. So to register for a chance to win, text RFL to 66866. Again, text RFL to 66866. Additionally, ARO is offering RFL listeners a $25 discount by using code RFL at checkout and a free 6-month subscription for a limited time. Order your ARO today at goaro.com, G-O-A-R-O.com, and use the promo code RFL. Scott Sauls, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, you guys. Great to see you and great to be with you, as always.
Well, we love the chance to sit down and get to talk with you about what we're talking about this summer, marriage and parenting. And you're someone who's been in a faithful marriage for how many years now?
We're 27. Yeah, it'll be 28 this August. Still feels like we're just getting started.
There you go.
But just getting...
And you've launched some people as well.
That's right. That's right. You've had some experiences. You're a little bit ahead of us, and we've always appreciated your counsel and wisdom in how you navigate that.
How old are the girls right now?
Yeah, Abby is 24. She just got married, and she and Jeff are moving to New York City next month. So back to the...
Following in footsteps.
Place of her origin. And then... Ellie is a sophomore at Auburn, so she's 19 and just having a blast with life. So yeah, it's just Patty and me at home now. It's wonderful, you guys, to have the flexibility, but we really miss our kids too.
Yeah. How did it feel to have her head back to New York? What is it like for you, the nostalgia of all that?
Oh, so excited for her. I mean, you know, we moved her it wasn't the perfect time when we moved her to Nashville. She was just going into freshman year, and you know what it's like to live in New York City. I mean, she was a kid that was formed there. And so she never really felt like she fit in kind of the Nashville suburban culture where we are right now, and always longed on some level to get back to urban living. And so she's really excited. And her husband's going to be with the Mets. So that's going to be really exciting too, because they're having a great year.
And you like baseball. That sounds like a great experience.
So. Yeah, he's going to try to work himself up to shortstop from the marketing department. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, I love talking to a pastor when we talk about marriage and we talk about parenting, because you have in and out of your life for so many years. You're dealing with marriages that are many times at the point of complete crisis, or there's been a trauma or an event that's taken place that they're trying to recover from. And And you really have to help people get back to the basics of like, what are we doing here? You know, what, why are we even doing marriage? Like, what is this about? And I'd love to hear just some of your insights because you've written this awesome book on beautiful people don't just happen. And it's in these marriage crises and these moments that I would imagine that the sharpening of the diamond, you know, the uncovering like what's really there can happen. In some cases, it doesn't.
Yeah.
People split, they're done, it's over. But you've walked through this with people and seen the other side. So give us a little insight into what happens in those moments for people.
Well, it sounds like you're echoing the Tim Keller endorsement because he did the whole coal forming into a diamond thing in his endorsement.
Oh, did he?
So that's kind of fun.
That's awesome.
But yeah, maybe great, it's just minds. Great, brilliant minds think alike, Gabe. But but yeah, I mean, I think that's a really great metaphor for what a marriage crisis can become. You know, sadly, most marriage crises don't become that because it takes both parties to be really, really willing to dig in and do the work. It takes immense work to sustain a healthy, life-giving marriage, let alone one that's, you know, hit a place of crisis and then you've got all the human pride and hurt feelings and feelings of betrayal in the midst of all of it. And But for those situations where kind of the desperation that both parties have reached and they want to get out of that desperation and they have the wisdom to realize that the best way out of that desperation is to work on the marriage and do the work, those are the marriages, you guys, that actually end up becoming the strongest ones, is the ones that have been through the ditch, the pit, the abyss, you know, kind of on the brink of ending things. And somehow, some way, a community, especially a community of faith, comes around them and they respond. And it takes time. It's not immediate. It actually takes the rest of a couple's lifetime to restore. But there's something about it. You know, Paul talks about, you know, in Galatians 6, you know, you who are spiritual, restore gently, you know, those who have been caught in transgression. And the word there, you know, in the Greek, the only other place they could find it in Greek literature, you know, back in New Testament times was in medical journals where they talked about resetting a broken bone or restoring a broken bone. And, you know, Gabe, you're an athlete. Rebecca, I don't know if you're an athlete. You probably are, but you know that if you break a bone and then they reset it properly, the bone, all the osteo people will say the bone is actually twice as strong or more than it was before it was broken. And I think that metaphor plays out in human restoration, especially in marriages. Again, like some of the best elders I've ever worked with are ones that I walked through the brink of divorce with, you know, some years prior, and they responded. And the Bible tells us the gospel is the power of God to resurrect what's dying or dead. And so yeah, I'm a super fan of restoration. I've seen some great stories.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're digging into it in this season, in particular with the intention around it, right? Like the deliberate pursuit of something to be restored. Because I think what we're referring to in marriages that don't wind up finding that restoration is that they feel buried by something, overcome by shame. The narrative has gone for so long. They don't have the imagination for it to change and really just feel like when despair sets in, I know that's when you believe things can never really change. And that agreement with the phrase, it is what it is, right? Like that where we are is where we are. It's not going to change. And you're right. Both parties have to actually be willing to go, we can't fathom this changing, but are we open still to trying to recover something? And I think people have a window of tolerance for how long they'll try that. And I would love to get your thoughts on what is the outlying effect? What is the outlier for those who go, I have a window of tolerance for a season, and then they hit a turning point versus the ones who are just like, yeah, we're good.
Yeah, I mean, what I would love in those situations is to be able to encourage maybe even a next level optimism beyond tolerance, maybe a season of hope, as opposed to merely tolerance, because you know tolerance allows us to continue to despise the person across from us. I'm just putting up with this. I'm putting up with you, but. You know, there's a thinly veiled hatred that can sometimes be the undercurrent of tolerance. But if if you can allow yourself to hope that the gospel is true, that there have been many a train wreck marriage that has gone before you that has been restored. And there are actually many autobiographical books, written by people who've been through those stories and have seen fit to share them. To know that God can restore the most broken and dead and dying things.
How do people find that hope?
Well, obviously, from my perspective as a Christian, my first answer to that is that the gospel of Jesus Christ is the power of God for salvation, not only for entry into the kingdom of God, but for newness of life and restoration and renewal. But I have to say that the odds go way up when you enlist an excellent counselor who's deeply rooted in the gospel and also deeply rooted in marriage dynamics and family dynamics, and a safe, non-condemning, accountable Christian community of maybe 5 or 6 people or other couples around you, and then add to that maybe an older mentor couple who has been through what you're going through right now, and make a firm commitment for a firm period of time to, you love the word rhythm, right? You've written on rhythms, a rhythm of putting yourself into these kinds of relationships repeatedly in a scheduled way, maybe for 6 months or a year or whatever your hope meter will allow for, and see what happens. Bonhoeffer famously said that the word of Christ is stronger on my brother's mouth than it is in my heart. And so the more we can hear the truth and beauty and hope that the gospel brings to dead and dying things and dead and dying people from the lips of others. Just think about how Paul in Colossians, he doesn't just say sing to God, he says sing to each other. We need to hear the word of God from each other's voices in the same way that Moses needed Aaron and Hur to hold his arms up when he was weak. But if a couple is willing to subject themselves to the combination of safety and accountability, if both parties are willing to admit that they are contributors to the problem, that they are not, nobody is 100% victim in the vast majority of cases, even if your spouse, is 95% of the problem, understand that 5% is something that's important for you to work on as your contribution. And then the other part is the forgiveness that you're called to extend and not hold the past over the other person, but do the hard work to see them through the eyes of Christ and the eyes of the gospel, the eyes of grace and redemption. Easier said than done. It's so easy and fun to preach sermons on this stuff. It's very hard to walk through, but it's doable because God is more powerful. Jesus Christ and his resurrection are more powerful than any abyss that we find ourselves in. And so, the key ingredient there is hope.
So good.
Scott, I know you've walked through that abyss and the dark night of the soul, and you talk so honestly about this. I've really appreciated, even as a pastor, just being open and transparent about your own battles with anxiety, depression. In a marriage, when one spouse is walking through that, it often is complicated for the partner to know how to best love in that season, how to not just sort of pat on the back and say, oh, it'll be fine, get over it. How did Patty help you through that season? How can other couples that are listening, whichever end of this that they're experiencing right now, be a little more equipped for that season?
So, that's a great question. And our marriage is unique in that we have both traveled that road and never together at the same time, thankfully. And I think that's good. A mercy from God that we've both been able to show up for one another, knowing what it's like. And, I think the trickier question is to be able to show up for your spouse when you don't know what it's like. A posture of no condemnation is very important because some of the battles that people fight, they trace back to childhood trauma. Maybe you had a much happier, safer upbringing, for instance, than your spouse did. That plays in. And then there's the fact that it's not just our souls and our wills that are fallen, but our bodies and our brains, our are subject to the fall and subject to, you know, varying psychological and physiological wounds and damage that comes to us from the fall. And so some people have a disadvantaged brain, you know, relative to others in terms of their capacity to bear certain burdens. And so I think compassion for the uniqueness of every human being, every person's story, every person's makeup, you know, some people are more anxiously disposed, and there's a negative side to that, a shadow side to that, but there's also a positive side to that. Like, anxious people tend to really get things done in the world as well, you know, like when they're at their best, you know, and sad people, you know, people who are disposed toward melancholy, you know, at the worst, you know, at the bottom, they can, you know, fall to an abyss of depression, but at their best, you know, they see what's broken in the world, like the Enneagram 4, right? They see it and they want to address it and they want to show up with compassion. And so just recognize, you know, and this doesn't just apply to mental health issues. It also applies to just anything broken about the person you're living with. You know, that, you know, I think Philippians 1:6 is really helpful. I'm confident that he who began, which means they're not complete yet, who began a good work in you will be faithful until the day of Christ Jesus. You know, one of the things I love about that verse is it says that we can fall in love not only with the person in front of us and who they are right now, but especially with who they're becoming. You know, I love what C.S. Lewis says in The Weight of Glory about how, you know, we've never met a mere mortal. Every person that we meet, you know, whether we snub or exploit them or whether we're tempted to worship them, you know, one day in Christ, they're going to be so glorious and so completed that if we were to see them in their future state, we would be tempted to fall down and worship. You know, it's kind of like, you know, looking at the caterpillar, envisioning the butterfly, or, you know, looking at the crushed acorn, but envisioning the oak tree or the forest that lies ahead. And so, you know, if we can fall in love again and again and again with future eyes, you know, based on what God says this person is becoming. But that takes faith. That takes faith.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that book and the vision that it casts. It's just, again, this picture of the now and the not yet, right? Like, we are caught in the in-between, but we do see that glimpse. We see through that glass darkly, but there's a glimpse. There's a glimpse of, like, wow, this is beautiful. And I think even in, sometimes you see those in the most broken moments, like that light shines through. We had someone who was kind of a friend who talked about, like, Pixar had a gleam, they called it a gleaming detail.
Okay.
In the middle, like, of a tragedy that always would show through the narrative arc of the film. And it was almost this, like, this symbol of, like, this is still the glory that is being pursued throughout. And so even in art, like, that's kind of one of the necessary ingredients to the fullness, right, of that glimpse of it.
Thanks to Pine Cove Summer Camps for supporting the Rhythms for Life podcast. Pine Cove is excited to announce they're opening a new overnight youth camp in Georgia, the Pine Cove Springs. Pine Cove is a Christian camp with over 50 years of experience. They are bringing Christ-centered, others-focused, and seriously fun counselors and activities to their new overnight youth camp in Georgia, the spring, serving 4th through 8th graders. My first overnight camp happened in 4th grade, changed my life, made me a camper from then on. So if you are wanting to join, spots are still available for summer 22. Check out pinecove.com/springs and use the code RHYTHMS250. For $250 off a first-time overnight youth camp registration at the Pine Cove Springs.
So for husbands, and I'm kind of asking for a friend, but maybe myself, but the emotional health side, you've talked so well about emotional health, and I feel like, not to be stereotypical, but women tend to have a little more intuitive nature around emotions, what they're feeling at the moment, and how to maybe express that, or how to navigate, like, what's going on relationally around them. And that's not true of all women. It's not true of all men that they don't. But for men that struggle with this, and I know Rebecca and I, in the marriage retreats that we host, we hear so many wives articulate, "I wish my husband would be more vulnerable." Mm-hmm. And the husband's sitting there going, "I don't even know what that means. I don't know how to do that. It doesn't feel natural for me."
Yeah.
And yet we know that connection could happen more if the husband would just learn the skill and understand, like, what would that look like to practice it? Could you just describe a little bit of how you would coach
husband in how to be more vulnerable?
Absolutely. I mean, that's there's an entire section in Beautiful People Don't Just Happen on what a friend of mine calls the skill of lament. You know, to use the word you just used, it's a skill. But my friend calls it a necessary skill in the art of rejoicing. In other words, we can only know joy to the degree that we understand the contrast, or the, you know, what Francis Schaeffer would call the antithesis of joy, which would be lament. And, you know, I'm doing a lot of work around emotions. So this is a really timely question that I especially appreciate, maybe more than I would have 10 years ago, Gabe. I'm working with a guy named Chip Dodd, who is a counselor who specializes in what he calls the eight core emotions. And, you know, those emotions are very interesting. And they can all be found in the Psalms all over the place. And so if anybody says, you know, a man's skill is not to be emotional, just look at King David, look at Jesus who wept at, and got angry at the tomb of Lazarus. It's in there. But I think especially as Western American men, we are so programmed by the secondhand smoke of the culture that we live in, that we breathe in every day, that succeeding is everything. That, you know, especially in the world of social media, curating a together image is so, you know, essential. And in the process, it's eroding our souls. And it is incapacitating ourselves from being fully human, right? Like, you know, in the same way that, you know, so many of us guys, we work out so that we have a nice looking exterior, right? Like as best we can. Like I'm kind of a hopeless case, Gabe, but you're pretty ripped. So like you work out. Why? So you'll look good, right? And so you'll feel good, but especially so you'll look good, so people will think that you've got, you know, your physical act together. And yet we do so little to address the inner life. And we could talk about that all day in terms of rhythms that can help us with that. But the emotional life is just as much a part of us to be stewarded and worked out as our physical life, as our brains, as our muscles. And so that here's the curious thing, though. The eight emotions that Chip has identified, and again, there's a whole section in the book that I write about this, focusing especially on recovering the skill of lament. The eight emotions are gladness. That's a positive one, right? It's kind of an umbrella that encompasses all of our happy feelings. But then here are the other seven: guilt, shame, sadness, hurt, fear, anger, and loneliness. They're all distress-related emotions that God, I think God in his kindness, has given us seven different ways to respond to a tragic world. And one way to remind us of the world that's to come. And, you know, I wonder what it's going to be like in glory, what our emotional lives will be like, and how, what the texture will look like. Because, you know, all the distressed emotions will be gone. So what will they be replaced with? Just maybe a world of gladness. I don't know. But those are all emotions meant to be stewarded, meant to be matured, and meant to be expressed. And, you know, there's an unhealthy expression of all eight of them. And there is a healthy and life-giving expression of all eight of them. And so you know, the inner life task, which I think you're right, generally speaking, Gabe, and there are exceptions, that women just tend to be more in touch with this stuff. But the ability to lament openly, which was something that Middle Eastern culture did, that first century New Testament culture did, like when you went to a funeral, it wasn't quiet. I mean, everybody was wailing. And it was appropriate. Like there was nobody running around saying, don't get so emotional. There was no grieving family member that's apologizing for their tears, which often happens at our Western funerals. Like people are apologizing for being sad that they've lost a loved one because they feel like, you know, their Americanness requires them to maintain composure when they're falling apart inside.
Do you think that's why Americans... because they feel like they're just not allowed. Do you think that because they've had to hold in, I've done a little bit of research on this, but I'm curious your thoughts, because they've had to hold it in and stay composed in the grief and the lament, that's why we're more sick as a society? That's why we have the unrest, because we've not had permission or given ourselves permission to actually grieve as a normal person should, what's appropriate? Like somehow that was covered in shame and we had to just bury it internally?
What a great insight that is. And I think the answer is absolutely yes. And it's not only when we hold in distressed emotions. It's also when we hold in our joyful emotions. You know, a couple of images came to mind as you're talking, Rebecca. One is a sponge, right? Like you can pour water. Let's just say water represents all our different emotions. You can pour it into a sponge, but eventually the sponge can't hold anymore. And unless you squeeze it and release it to let the water out, it's going to be heavy. And I think that's a metaphor for the life, like the life that we carry throughout the day. If it's not filled with various expression of our emotions, throughout the day, it's going to be a heavy existence. The other image is a water balloon, right? Like you fill it up, but there's eventually the exterior, which is what we're always trying to curate, right? And curate our brand or curate our image, however we end up doing that. But eventually, if the rubber of the balloon represents what we're curating externally, the more you fill it with unexpressed, water, unreleased water, unexpressed, unreleased emotion, it's going to eventually combust. It won't be able to handle it. You have to let it out. It's meant to be exhaled, just like the carbon dioxide is meant to be exhaled from our lungs after the oxygen converts to carbon dioxide. We have to get rid of it. And the great thing is it actually blesses the world when we do, because the trees and the plants all thrive on carbon dioxide in the same way that we thrive on oxygen. And they exhale oxygen, we inhale it, we exhale carbon dioxide, and the plants and the world inhale it. And it's just a happier, better world. And tons of great metaphors.
It reminds me just the input and the output of rhythm, right? Like you can't give what you haven't received. Mm-hmm. And then when you do receive it, you have to give because you can't get more if you have no capacity for it, right? Like you can't continue to have. Mm-hmm. I know for me, like nothing shifts the trajectory of me in a particular season than like a big ugly cry at some point. Like if I'm like getting up to here of feeling overwhelmed with like a lot of decision fatigue or just adrenal fatigue from going, if I can't at some point find tears, that's where I'm at with it. It's not all the time, every day. I'm kind of high functioning until I'm not. And then in that moment, I realize if I don't tell the truth right now about how buried I feel, then the tears won't come. And if the tears don't come, there won't be a lift.
That's right. And think about it.
That's just come from a lot of years of crying.
Think about it too. Say you've got two people holding in everything. When you're holding in so much, you have such limited or even no capacity to receive what the other person is meant to exhale. you know what I mean? Like, if your culture insists that everybody hold it in because the highest cultural value is to keep your act together, to never let them see you sweat, as that old commercial said, you have a bunch of jacked up, high octane stress,
combustible
people walking around pretending like flammable. Everything's okay when it's not.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me when you said we have to also express joy. Last night, Pierce got a call, which he's been a huge Justin Bieber fan
since he was 8.
Uh-huh. I mean, literally,
that's when he started busking in New York City.
And so, so there's a show tonight in town, and he gets a call last night from his friend that basically said, "Hey, I've got an extra ticket. Do you want to go?" And he didn't have a ticket. And he was trying to make a plan to try to figure out how to get a ticket, but it wasn't going to probably happen. And so he gets this call, and he's out in the yard doing yard work, and I'm really far away, but I don't know what the call is about. But all I hear is him just screaming, like in joy, like so excited. Like it just was a mile long. You could have heard him a mile away.
Yeah.
And I just thought how sweet that is for him to express himself, right?
Good, like, for Pierce.
We got to also express the joy. But
I thought you were going to say that Justin Bieber called him.
Not quite, but we're working on that. No, I'm kidding. But the other thing about Pierce is that he's also very in touch with tears. And I think the lower you can go, the higher you can go. There's that window of expansion of emotion that when you can like be well acquainted with grief, I think you're well acquainted with joy. Like you're just less limited in the expression.
So Chip Dodd, you mentioned him, and in closing, I've appreciated his book, Voices of the Heart, which for anybody listening, just that's a great book to take you through these 8 emotions. It was really helpful for me. because it more put emotions into some sort of a logical framework, which is where I tend to hang out. And so it was really educational and helpful. But the thing he says about those emotions that God gave us is when we feel them, I think they all point us back towards relationship, right? They typically are designed to say you need someone else in this with you. So for final question, what's a rhythm that couples can practice that would allow them to experience this idea of expressing emotion daily, of trying to get the joy out, but also some of the grief and things that they're experiencing? What kind of rhythms would you encourage people to try out maybe this week? Like, just see how this works.
Yeah, I mean, I think whenever Patty and I are trying to develop this practice, right? And it's kind of a new thing for us to exchange in the place of the question, what are you thinking right now? A new question, what are you feeling right now? It's a real game changer when you can invite that kind of vulnerability out of one another and then express that vulnerability when you feel like you've been invited, that somebody's that you love and they love you is drawing it out of you. And so even just thinking about, you know, the curiosity that we, how we express our curiosity about the other to one another, ask about emotions. Even, you know, and to take that to the next level, when you're in conflict with each other, ask that question. And be willing to, you know, sit there and engage back and forth about how it's making you feel. Well, I'm scared. I feel like you might be rejecting me, or I'm hurt because I feel like you're committed to misunderstanding me right now, or I'm sad, or I'm angry, you know, and but there's a lot of intimacy that's on the other side of that.
It'll feel awkward for people who aren't used to that question. And so you're kind of like, no, that's going to take us down a rabbit hole I'm not ready for. But it's like anything, you can retrain your brain of going like, hey, this doesn't have to be like the end of the world. You can practice your way into it. And then all of a sudden your brain is going, oh, this is a new neural pathway that I actually feel better when this is done. I this is a desired thing that I want to come back to versus a thing that I've avoided and rejected for a long time. One last really quick, like 30 seconds. You talk about contentment, and I love this question because I think about this often in this passage. So give us your elevator pitch on contentment, because this is something I think that really does impact our view of ourselves and the world and God in it.
Yeah. So my elevator pitch on contentment is, chapter one and also the chapter on Ecclesiastes. And so, you know, my more developed thoughts are there, and Beautiful People Don't Just Happen on this subject in particular. I've got a conversation with our friend Elizabeth Hasselbeck in about 2 hours on that very subject on Instagram Live.
I bet you do.
I don't know if she's going to save it on her Instagram or not, but maybe your listeners can go to Elizabeth's Instagram and see if she's, you know, kept it up there. But in any event, I think that, the secret of contentment is, of course, based on Paul's writing in his letter to the Philippians. It's important to know that he wrote that from prison while he's under house arrest, under conditions of great pressure, facing his own death. And yet that letter has become historically known by the church as the epistle or the letter of joy. That is the letter where he wrote the words, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. And it's also the letter where he talked about how he has learned the secret of being content. It's something that has to be learned. It doesn't come automatically. The Holy Spirit typically doesn't zap us with contentment. It involves something else that Paul wrote about in Philippians, working out our salvation with fear and trembling, not working on our salvation, not working for it, but working out our salvation like we work out our muscles, like take something we already have that we're not going to lose, our salvation, and work it out to make it stronger and more resilient. And the remarkable thing that Paul says, though, is that I think we miss, because we think about the secret of contentment is something we need when we're really struggling, right? But he says, I've learned the secret of contentment when I'm living in want. But he also says, I've learned the secret of contentment when I'm living in plenty, which is where Ecclesiastes comes in, right? You've got this guy who's crushing it, right? And he's miserable. And so, you know, getting everything you always wanted, as Thomas Merton once said, sometimes it's like, you know, climbing the ladder of success all your life. You get to the top of the ladder and you realize you're leaning against the wrong wall. And so Paul says, look, I've had great seasons of success and great seasons of sorrow and defeat, and I've learned a steadiness of contentment and joy through all of it. Y'all know from my Q talk, like my favorite example of this in real time is Tim Keller, as he's, you know, fighting cancer, facing his own death. His cancer's incurable. And I'm like, I've had Zoom calls with him where he's got chemo in his arm. And he's just so lighthearted. He's like, can you believe this little thing costs $9,000 a day? Can you believe that? You know, and like, he's not even focusing on his disease. And if anybody asks him, and he's done this in interviews too, you know, how are you feeling? He's like, I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And, you know, and because he sees what's next, you know, whenever his days here are done, his new life begins, his eternal life, you know, becomes what he's always dreamed of and prepared himself for. But, you know, this is my last plug for formation and your teaching on rhythms, Rebecca. Tim Keller became that person because of rhythms, daily, quiet, private, sometimes boring, you know, plodding through the genealogies in Leviticus, rhythms, where for over 60 years, he prays through 5 Psalms a day, every day. For over 60 years, he reads through the whole Bible every single year, at least once. He listens to criticism, receives it, takes notes on it so that he can find something in there to repent of, even if it's unfair criticism, which I find remarkable. And has a robust life of prayer. He's written a whole book on it, but it's real. Like his public ministry and his private life are very congruent. But you don't, if I could just read this quote from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, I think this is a remarkable description of what Tim has become. Can I close my remarks with this brief quote?
Yeah, please do.
Do we have time?
Please do. Yes.
And this is actually the basis for the book as well. But whenever I read this, I think of Tim and just those formational rhythms over the course of his many, many years of life and the person that he is, the diamond that he's become because of it. So here goes. This is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She says, the most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of the depths. These people have an appreciation, a sensitivity, and an understanding of life that fills them with compassion, gentleness, and a deep loving concern. Beautiful people do not just happen. So.
Yeah, so good. That's great. Love it. So, so beautiful. I'm thankful for that. I heard a podcast recently where Eugene Peterson, it was an older one, was just saying he prays through the same 7 Psalms for years,
amazing,
like every week, you know, amazing. And it's the, you're right, the formation that provides in the secret place, the hidden thing with God is the vitality that everything else flows from. So thank you for this work. Thank you for, you put so many wonderful things out in the world. I know this one is going to push people in the best of ways to be willing to lean in and consider the work worth it, consider themselves worthy of the work, to not shy away from it. So thank you for doing this.
Thanks, you guys.
Wasn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I love Scott, how candid he is, and he just gives everyone permission inside of ministry, outside of ministry. Just be honest with where you are, and your testimony has so much power attached to it.
Yeah,
I love that about him.
It's a good example of vulnerability. It invites us in. I think listening back to that, you feel invited in to dig a little deeper, to not be ashamed of the things that we're walking through, and to understand how important it is to sharing and how much connection can happen out of that in our marriages and in our family. Well, next week, we don't want you to miss the conversation we're going to have with Josh and Christy Straub. They're the authors of a book as well as an organization called Famous at Home. And I don't know if you feel this way, but sometimes I don't feel famous at home. It's like other people appreciate who I am. I know, Rebecca, you walk through that. You travel. People know who you are. But man, when you come home, do our kids feel that way? Are our kids excited that we're all home? Are our kids just as into us as parents? And, you know, that's convicting because we have to sit and think about, like, how are we doing at home? And Josh and Christy are going to help us press into that.
Yeah, it's a conversation you won't want to miss. But before we take off for today, make sure you grab Scott Saul's book, Beautiful People Don't Just Happen, and share this podcast if it impacted you. Rate and review. That helps other people find the podcast. And we can't wait to see you next week.